From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Gambling is all over American life these days and still growing. A dozen states have commercial casinos, 28 have Indian casinos, 43 have lotteries. We've got slots at the track, poker on the internet, scratch tickets all over. It's hard to believe that in living memory, gaming was almost nowhere, and gambling was a vice, if not sin, straight up. Is this okay? And will it still pay if everybody's in on the games? This hour on Point, Casino Nation and gambling on a roll in America. You can join the conversation. Where are we headed here? A casino on every corner? Is this good fun, good money, or a problem? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me first today from Memphis, Tennessee, is Michael Nelson, professor of political science at Rhodes College and a senior fellow at the Miller Center on Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. He's studied gambling as it plays out across the country. He's author of Governing Gambling and his brand new book, How the South Joined the Gambling Nation. Michael Nelson, welcome. Wonderful to have you with us.
Thanks, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well. I wish you'd be good enough just to paint a picture for us to begin with of gambling in this country today. How widespread, how big the money, how important?
Well, it's huge. And when you say that in living memory, there was a time when legalized gambling in the form of casinos and lotteries essentially didn't exist in this country. You're absolutely right. You don't have to go back that far, not even 50 years, to a time when no state had a lottery, when only one state, Nevada, had casinos. And so over the course of less than 50 years, we've become a gambling nation, if you will. And for the most part, that's occurred, even though it's a national trend, it's occurred because individual states have decided to get into the gambling business or to allow casino companies to get into the gambling business. American Indian tribes have gotten into the gambling business with a green light from the federal government. And so it's hard to find. There are only two states in the United States where you can't gamble legally, and one of them is Utah and the other is Hawaii.
What was it, Michael Nelson, remind us, that tripped off the great gambling rush, and what is the dynamic that keeps gambling growing and growing?
Well, you know, in the late 70s, it's a crucial time for the takeoff of legalized gambling, and it's also a crucial time for the kind of rise in American politics of the anti-government, anti-tax sentiment, which has dominated for so long. Remember Proposition 13 in California in 1978, limiting the amount of taxation by the state government, and then the Reagan Revolution with the emphasis on tax cuts. What that meant was that states were finding it much harder to raise new revenues through new taxes or through tax increases. And there were plenty of people in those state governments who said, well, you know, here's a way to bring in some money. We won't call it a tax because it's not mandatory. We'll create a lottery and we'll have the state get into the business of operating a gambling technique, and we'll profit from the money, meaning the state treasury. That's a way of getting revenue. Or we'll legalize casino gambling in our state. It'll be operated by private companies, but we can tax them at a pretty good rate. And so you can call it a voluntary tax, you can call it whatever you will, but it was a strategy for states to get money without having to make the unpopular decision of increasing taxes.
And more of them looking at doing just that. Massachusetts, where I'm sitting, but also plans to get into gambling or expand gambling in Kentucky, Kansas, California, and beyond. And the money has come in. I mean, I'm looking here just at state revenues from commercial casinos, not Indian, not lottery, but Illinois, $830 million last year. Indiana, $833 million. Louisiana, half a billion dollars. Michigan, $349 million. Mississippi, $300 million. Missouri, $424 million. Nevada, of course, Las Vegas, over a billion. Has this been a fiscal success for the states that have jumped into the gambling game, Michael Nelson?
Well, if you add it all up, we're talking about over $5 billion a year coming into state treasuries in 2006 from taxes on commercial casinos. That doesn't even count the lotteries. It's a fiscal success for those states that can attract people in from other states to gamble, to lose money, which most people will do, and leave behind profits in those casinos that the states can then take a share of in taxes. It's not a winning strategy if your casinos in your state just draw on people from your state. And that's one of the reasons why in a lot of states that have gotten into the casino business, if you will, they've allowed casinos to operate, but only at the borders. So in Mississippi, for example, you won't find casinos in the middle of the state, but you'll find them along the Mississippi River where they can attract in customers from Memphis, from Arkansas, from out of state. You'll find them on the Gulf Coast where they bring in people from nearby Louisiana, for example. So casino legalization is a reasonable strategy for economic development, for revenue raising in certain circumstances. It may not work everywhere. So the idea of a casino on every street corner is probably not going to be smart business for a casino company. It's probably not going to generate much for state treasuries. But if they're strategically located, then there's a chance of the state getting a windfall from people coming in from out of state and leaving their money behind on the gaming floor.
So there's a kind of a casino arms race there, and you know they may not be on every corner, but it can sometimes feel that way these days. Michael Nelson, if I don't know, Americans from, I don't know, 40 or 50 years ago could glimpse the high profile of gambling in the United States today, what do you think they would make of it? I mean, the culture has changed. What do you think Americans from, 1957 would think of what we've got in gambling today in this country?
Well, one thing they would notice is that there are fewer illegal casinos. I mean, places like Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Covington, Kentucky, used to be hotbeds of illegal casino gambling. Well, they've been pretty much driven out of business by a combination of law enforcement and the legalization of casinos. People might notice that racetracks, horse racetracks, and dog racetracks are not as big a deal as they used to be. And when they are, it's because they've gotten into the racino business, as it's called, racetrack casinos.
But would they be shocked that there are casinos all over the place now and state governments putting their imprimatur on them?
I think they would be shocked, and I think what would be even more shocking is the idea that 42 state governments, 43 if you add in the District of Columbia, have actually gotten into the gambling business with the creation of state lotteries. We've never had that before in American history, where the state government said, we want you to gamble and we're going to profit from your gambling. And that's what a state lottery is. And of course, where do those profits come from? It's from people toward the lower end of the educational ladder, toward the lower end of the income ladder. That, I think, is the real transformation in American culture, is the idea that the moral authority of the state has been diminished by getting into the gambling business.
Or thrown behind gambling, which is quite a picture. Michael Nelson in Memphis, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation with me now in the studio, Alan Wolf. He's director of the Boise Center for Religion and American Public Life, professor of political science at Boston College. He's hosting a major conference later this month at Boston College on gambling and the American moral landscape. It's an issue in this state, as in many others right now. Alan Wolf, thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure, Tom.
Michael Nelson just begins to touch on the cultural implications of the quite astounding growth of gambling in this country. You're writing recently about how odd it is, in a way, that there has been so little debate over this enormous growth of what was once seen in many quarters as sin.
No, that's right. I mean, if you look at other issues that people believe are sinful, some people believe that homosexuality is a sin, you see a huge debate. Abortion, some people think that's sinful, you see a huge debate. Then you come to gambling, and it's like the sound of one hand clapping. There's no debate. I was absolutely fascinated by Michael Nelson's statistics and by the story he told. He traces the rise of gambling back to the late 1970s. Mm. And he's absolutely right about that. It's kind of the byproduct of the Howard Jarvis campaign against taxation in California. In that sense, the American right, by cutting taxes and by encouraging people to think that there are other ways that states could raise money, have oddly given rise to gambling when most conservative people in the United States, and certainly conservative religious believers, Southern Baptists, used to think that gambling was a sin.
Duly noted, and Billy Sunday would probably jump out of his pulpit if he could see it now. But you also point out that the left, you quote Walter Rauschenbusch, left-wing founder of the social gospel, called gambling the vice of the savage. Mm-hmm. But the American left, you say, has also been interestingly mute on this very regressive, in effect, taxation.
Yeah, that's right. We're actually in the exact 100th anniversary of the publication of Walter Rauschenbusch's book on the social gospel in 1907. Walter Rauschenbusch was a very famous liberal mainline Protestant. He actually made a comparison between gambling and the stock market. And he said both are vices of the savage. For him, if you were against capitalism, you would be against capitalism in its rawest, most naked form, and that would be gambling. There was no moral difference at all between investing in the stock market and throwing your money away for a left-wing writer like him.
Michael Nelson, should we have had a debate about gambling, a bigger debate in this country? Should we still have it? Is it too late?
Well, you know, we almost did in the mid-1990s, and that's when in Congress conservative Republicans pushed for the creation of a national commission to study the impact of the spread of legalized gambling. And in a sense, that study, which was meant to come up with all sorts of dire conclusions about the effects of lotteries and casinos and the coming threat of internet gambling, got I won't say captured, but its moral impetus got muted by political pressure from the casino industry.
Well, we're going to take the mute button off today and hear the debate. Michael Nelson in Memphis and Alan Wolf with me. Please stand by. We're talking about the casino nation. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the casino nation. Our nation, gambling, taking over in America, a country where people would rather roll the dice than pay more taxes. Michael Nelson is with us. He's author of How the South Joined the Gambling Nation, just published, and of course is not just the South. From Massachusetts to Kansas to California, states are looking, more states, at diving in or expanding what they're already doing. He joins us from Memphis, Tennessee. With me in the studio, Alan Wolf, director of the Boise Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College, author of Return to Greatness, How America Lost Its Sense of Purpose and What It Needs to Do to Recover It. You can join the conversation. How do you see gambling in America? Is it a godsend, a sign of moral decline, just a good time? And why are we turning to lotteries and slots and casino gambling to raise money instead of just paying taxes to do it? Do you have casino gambling in your state, your town? Do you love it, hate it, wish it had never come, wish you had more? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I want to go straight to our listeners. Raheem is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Raheem, you're on the air. Hello, Raheem, are you there? May have lost Raheem. Let's go to another call here from Shelburne, Vermont. Gene, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Pretty well.
I got two kind of anecdotal things, but they're true, and you know they're true. When New York State, which was the first state to really push for this, this is lottery gambling to take it away from the mafia, which was raking it in tax-free, of course. So, and they promised at the time that this was going to go for education. It never went to education, but if it did go to education, I'd still be against it. I worked with a woman back then who I said, I was taking the New York Times position on that. I said, you know, it's good because it'll help students, you know, that kind of stuff. I believed in it then. And she said, you know, if you couldn't find the rent money to pay, maybe you would feel a little bit differently from that. And these people are addicted. And the argument for the Indians is, and I've heard this from people, and I respect my ex-wife, who said, well, this way they'll get back at the white man. I said, it's ridiculous. They're not going to get back at John Alden. You know, they're taking money out of poor people's mouths.
Gene, we've got it. Michael Nelson, what about the regressive face of gambling, lotteries, casino? Cut it a couple ways for us. Is it the case that it is, in fact, lower-income people who lose most of that money that goes to supporting schools or wherever states direct it?
Well, that's definitely true for lotteries. There's no question that, and there's a good bit of research on this, that around 80% of the lottery tickets that are bought in this country are bought by about 20% of the people who are intense repeat players, and they tend to be concentrated down at the lower end of the income ladder, the lower end of the educational ladder. And in states like Georgia and Tennessee and South Carolina, states where the money from the lottery really does go to education but goes primarily to fund college scholarships, you have poor people losing money in the lottery to send the children of the middle class and the upper middle class to college. Now, that's a hell of a way for a state to do business. It's a great thing to give college scholarships. But when the money is coming from people who can't afford it and going to people who probably could afford it, that's just outrageous.
Alan Wolf, take us back in here for another pass at this. I mean, you point out, and Michael Nelson does as well, that the kind of religious right, heirs to Billy Sunday, who campaigned against all vices, including gambling, might traditionally have been against this. That the left, just for the reasons that Michael Nelson just outlined, would certainly be against it. But that hasn't really happened. And I wish you'd take us, to the extent that you've started probing this, into what's going on with the American perspective here that immunizes gambling from those critiques.
Well, on the right, it's always been the case, but we really see it now, that the American right is torn between two quite contradictory impulses. One is a prohibitive impulse that goes back to Prohibition. Let's stop people. Let's not allow them to engage
control
in sinful behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The other is laissez-faire. Let people do whatever they want. If poor people want to spend their money on gambling, then God bless them, let them do that. The libertarian side of the Republican or conservative coalition really won out over the sin-obsessed side on this. You even saw some of the most prominent conservative Christian moralists like William Bennett themselves either being
gamblers
or Ralph Reed and Lewis Shelton, the conservative Christians involved with Jack Abramoff and the Indian tribes. So this
in promoting gambling.
Yeah, in a sense, this is a clear victory on the right of the libertarians over the social regulators. I wonder about this all the time. It's kind of a cherry-picking on the religious right. Why do we get so obsessed, if we're a conservative Christian, about the issue of gay marriage and so evidently little concern about what seems to me to be a people's impulsive behavior is really out of control.
But the prohibitive kind of impulse in American culture is not the only impulse there. I mean, there is, and you write as well, the permissive impulse.
Exactly. All of America, not just the right. I mean, we might say that the rise of gambling testifies to the fact that the puritanical strain in American culture is gone. But in fact, it's not. We have feminists against pornography. We try to regulate hate speech.
Mm-hmm.
No smoking is a campaign. In fact, as Father McGowan from Boston College has pointed out, 30, 40 years ago, smoking was the
smoking was cool and gambling was the vice.
Now it's the exact opposite. So we have an odd blend of permissiveness and prohibition. And on the right, I think it's pretty clear that the permissive side has won out over the prohibition.
On the left, then.
On the left, that's really fascinating as well. I think the idea on the left was that, well, conservatives have a political winner in this anti-tax movement, but we on the left, liberal governors believe, still have to raise money somehow. So it was kind of a Faustian pact. And maybe even in the beginning, things were a little less regressive than they became. In Georgia, as I learned from reading Mike Nelson's book, originally the Hope scholarships were funded out of gambling revenues and would benefit people down on the poor end. But it's been a long time since that. Why a liberal Democrat like our governor, Deval Patrick, would be so in favor of gambling in Massachusetts is a major question and is a source, of concern at this point, given what we now know about the regressive nature of gambling.
Michael Nelson, yes, please.
If I could add to that, you know, we've been talking about states either legalizing gambling or getting into the gambling business because they found it to be an attractive idea. But in many cases, a state has created a lottery or allowed casinos because the states that border on them have done so. And a lot of people from a state go into the state where they can buy a lottery ticket or play in a casino. The money leaves that state. And so back home, you say, well, you know, I don't like lotteries. I don't like casinos. But as a way of protecting ourselves from this drain of money out of our state into the neighboring state. We just got, it's like the arms race in that way. We don't want to have all these weapons, but as long as our enemies do, as long as our rivals do.
But you could say the same thing about prostitution across the state line, and still, I suppose, potentially, hypothetically, and states haven't, jumped into that behind Nevada.
Well, it took a long time before Nevada, which was the only casino state in the country for almost 50 years, before the next one came along, and that was New Jersey. So I don't know how long Nevada's allowed prostitution. Maybe we should add 50 years to that date and start watching out for that trend you're talking about.
But let me ask you, I mean, to the best of my recollection, in the Ten Commandments, it does not say thou shalt not start casinos. So, leave aside what Billy Sunday said, in a very contemporary calculation, do you see a moral case against it, Michael Nelson, or not?
Well, the Bible is hardly talks at all about gambling, and it's very equivocal. I mean, when the disciples had to replace Judas, they cast lots, mm-hmm. and so there's an example of throwing things up to chance. But gambling has been traditionally opposed by religious conservatives because of what it leads to. The person who loses money gambling then goes home and is a bad father or a bad husband. Or the idea that gambling promises to be, to those who gamble, a way of succeeding without working hard, which is part of kind of the Protestant culture.
Now that's an interesting thing. Ellen Wolf, do we lose or change something culturally when gambling becomes so high profile, so central to American life? I mean, this is sort of putting everything on chance instead of on the old Protestant work ethic.
Yeah. Oh, no. Gambling raises extraordinarily number of fascinating philosophical, theological, and religious issues. It's really a way of seeing the soul of a country. I would just add to what Michael Nelson said about religion and gambling. One of the most famous arguments for the existence of God is based on a wager, on a gamble. Pascal, the Blaise Pascal, the great French philosopher, made a very, very famous justification about, we don't know whether God exists. Are we better off betting that he does or that he doesn't? And concluded we're better off betting that he does.
I didn't think the religious were betting. I thought they were believing.
No, there is an element of, whenever you have an element of uncertainty, gambling enters into the picture. I mean, gambling is about the uncertainty. It's about fate. It's a subject of some of the greatest novels ever written, almost all of our great novelists have written about gambling.
So gambling's rooted in the church and religion?
I'm in particular an opera fanatic, and some of the greatest operas, Così fan tutte, is based on a wager. The Bartered Bride is based on a wager. I mean, so there's obviously something.
Life's a gamble.
Life's a gamble, and it does touch on all of these things. But, I still think that when you finally sort of come down to it, you don't have to be religious necessarily to believe that certain kind of behavior is, if not sinful, because non-religious people don't believe in sin, but there's something fundamentally wrong with the idea of people being allowed to destroy themselves. That, it seems to me, is the question. Should we say, for example, if we know that poor people lose from gambling overwhelmingly, and not only do they lose money, but they actually transfer money to people who are much wealthier than they are, we're faced with a fundamental philosophical question. Do we say freedom consists in doing whatever you want, and we shouldn't start the business of telling people what's good for them? Or do you say that freedom is more something you have to be cultivated, encouraged, and grow into? So every great philosophical, theological, and religious perspective can be applied to gambling. It's absolutely fascinating.
There's a core question, of course, bathed, though, right now in all kinds of neon light and razzmatazz out of the casinos. Let's go to a casino state, Connecticut, Stonington, Connecticut. And Mike, hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great talk.
Thanks. What do you know, Mike?
Well, I know that I live near the Mashutucket Casino, about 6 miles away, and it's been nothing but problems since they came in. It's been horrible to our school systems. It's been horrible to our social structure. It's basically changing the way of life of a very, old community. We're an old farm town. Land is going for, three, four times its normal value. Houses are outrageous. The folks, the natives that live here now, can't afford to live in the houses. Local school systems in the town of Ledyard, where Mashutuck is from, the kids have to pay $100 each to play sports. None of the money is coming back to the communities. It's been a scourge on everything. School systems have to hire translators. because of the number of immigrants that come and work, specifically Chinese folks. Some schools have to have 3 and 4 Chinese-speaking people to translate the education to the kids. It's been a nightmare.
Well, there's a picture. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mike, let me ask you, $100 a head kids are having to pay to play sports in a town where you've got a big casino? I thought it was supposed to shower, you know, the fruits of gambling all over you.
Well, you would think, you know, kids who want to play football have to pony up $100. If you have 4 kids in a family, that's $400 to play sports.
Mike, can you stick with us for a second? I want to take this to Michael Nelson, because Michael Nelson, as I read you, as I understand, for all your reservations, your conclusion was something different, that it did work out typically pretty well for the local community, if not even for the state at large.
Well, I said it can work out for some local communities. Now, what the caller's talking about is not a state government that said, we're going to allow a casino to operate in our state. It's an American Indian tribe, a federally recognized tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And because of a Supreme Court decision in the late 1980s, acknowledging that Indian tribes on their own lands are sovereign governments, just like the state government is a sovereign government, and can be allowed to offer casino gambling if the state allows anything like casino gambling. And in Connecticut, all they allowed were Las Vegas nights for charities to raise money, but that was enough under the law for the Pequot tribe, the Mashantucket Pequot tribe in Connecticut, to be able to open up a casino on its own land, and the state government wasn't able to do anything about that. Now, the tribe is operating the casino on its own land, but obviously the spillover into the community that the caller was describing is immense. Now, what the Pequots will tell you is, look, we kick in $400 million a year to the state treasury. We provide jobs for people who live in the surrounding community. We bring a lot of business into the state and so on. But clearly, the people who live around that tribal land where the casino is had no voice in whether it would be there or not. And because it's in a rural area, the amount of side effects on the lives of those communities has been huge. But they're in a special case, that tribe, because they are operating as a sovereign government on their own sovereign land.
Caller Mike in Stonington, Connecticut, what about that social cost you mentioned? How do you see that playing out in your town, in the lives of your fellow townspeople?
Taxes have risen significantly. The valuations of homes, which were once you could buy a good home for $150,000, are now $400,000. So the assessments have risen significantly. The cost of the school systems is gone up proponently. It's fire services, police services, just the amount of accidents, the amount of traffic in our area, how it affects just simple things like trying to get a restaurant reservation or trying to get a tee time on a golf course. The population has exploded. And it's people who come in for short periods of time and then they leave.
Mike, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. Let's get one more from Gambling Connecticut. Zoe's calling from New Haven, Connecticut. Hi, Zoe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I live too far from the casinos in Connecticut to comment on their impact on the local society.
Yeah.
And I don't have any particular moral problem with gambling. And it strikes me that the real issue here is that when people gamble in casinos, the odds are really poor. We are worried about the consequences for people of gambling in casinos when we don't worry about the odds of them gambling on the stock market so much, because at least you can expect a gain on the stock market. Anybody gambling in casinos or lotteries, really, if they face the arithmetic of it, can expect to lose money.
So it's their choice, no pity, no problem.
No problem. And what this reminds me of is when I was in Britain, when Britain introduced a national lottery, which is a way of raising money for all sorts of arts and sports and good stuff. And it was dubbed by the popular press as a tax on the stupid. I kind of like that.
Well, okay, we'll come back and look at a tax on the stupid or the fun-loving or whatever you want to call it. Zoe, thanks for your call. Michael Nelson in Memphis, please stand by. Alan Wolf with me here in Boston. Listeners, you can join us at 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Casino Nation, gambling taking over in America, a country where people would rather roll the dice than pay more taxes. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Wasn't gambling always a sin? Why isn't it now? Why isn't there a real anti-gambling movement in this country? Is the prevalence of gambling changing our view of life? Is chance starting to trump hard work? And with poorer Americans ending up paying more through gambling, well, is that right? And finally, how far will this go? A casino on every corner? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We've been joined by Alan Wolfe. He's director of the Boise Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. And from Memphis, Tennessee, by Michael Nelson, professor of political science at Rhodes College, author of the new book, How the South Joined the Gambling Nation. You can join us, 800-423-TALK. We'll hear in just a moment from one kind of participant in the gambling wars in Kansas. But first, let me go to Spokane, Washington, and Dave. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi, Dave. What do you know?
Hi, Alan and Michael.
Hi.
Hi, Dave. Well, what do you know? What's your story?
Well, I think this is a great debate. I'm really glad to hear it on the air. I've been, upset a little bit with the growth of the gambling industry for a long time, and I think it's great to be talking about it. My story, it just has to do with myself in college up at Gonzaga University right here in town.
Yep.
And my housemate, Tony, was a, just sort of the classic story of how somebody can get dragged down into gambling. And, we have a Kalispell Indian Tribe casino just out of town here.
Mm-hmm.
And he went up there, and he made the mistake of winning. And he felt like it was easy, and he turned $100 into a few thousand. And that money got spent on fun things and not on tuition or on books or on rent. And then when those things came due, he decided to take his $100 and turn it into enough money to pay for the things he had to pay for. And instead, he lost that $100. And ended up taking out loans and things that were, he took out that loan money, and instead of taking that loan money and buying books and paying rent, he went to gamble to turn it into more money. And I just think that kind of thing is classic, and it happens all the time, and it says a lot about the addicting nature of gambling. And I'd really like to hear some comments on that aspect.
Tony, Dave in Spokane will talk about exactly that. Look at Tony's story. It's the classic gambling story. Before we go exactly to that, let me bring one more voice into this conversation. And I promise you, Dave, we'll come to your question and point. First, joining us from Wichita, Kansas, is Richard Coe. He's a member of Stand Up for Kansas, an anti-gambling group of citizen activists that has also been helped by many religious groups. He's president of Coe Financial Services, a certified financial planner. The Kansas legislature passed a bill in March legalizing casinos in counties that vote for it. Richard Coe in Wichita, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Where does your county stand then on gambling at this point?
I'm very happy to report that Sedgwick County, the home of Wichita, the largest city in the state, voted against casinos in a referendum on August 7. We started out behind by 70% to 30%. Many people thought casinos were inevitable, Tom, but we ignited public opinion. We helped people understand the economics of the issues, and people from all walks of life, business leaders, church leaders, people from all over the community, stepped to the plate. We raised money, and we got the word out, and we defeated the gambling interests.
Mr. Coe, what was the argument that you made, or what argument was most persuasive?
Well, there were several arguments, I think, that were very persuasive. Number one, casinos would cannibalize local area businesses by an estimated $176 million a year. For the casinos to make money, they have to have losers, and the money that would be casino revenue is money that would have been spent on furniture or automobiles or restaurants or Christmas presents or birthday presents. So we hit the economic arguments very hard. And then
may I ask just on that front, Richard Coe, maybe they would have attracted in high rollers from, I don't know, Kansas City and Fargo, who would have lost their money and you would have been the winner in Wichita.
Well, that happens in Las Vegas. People come from all over the world, but we knew that it was very doubtful that people would fly in from Hartford or San Diego for casinos in Wichita. Kansas City, by the way, already has casinos. So most of these casinos that are popping up around the country are regional casinos, and they're taking money from their own people. It is not economic development. As Warren Buffett said, it's simply a transfer of money.
Well, you're in a big piece of the Bible Belt there. Was there strong religious opposition or not in Sedgwick County?
We had lots of help from a wide variety of churches, conservative churches, liberal churches, Catholic churches, Muslims, a wide variety of, we've never seen anything like this from the religious community. They got together and got in gear.
Why do you think Kansas at large hasn't pushed back against this? I mean, in a way, you're just one county of the many, many counties in Kansas. Aren't you kind of, pardon the expression, but kind of spitting in the wind here?
Correct. Unfortunately, Tom, I think many thought it was inevitable when this bill passed in March. It surprised a lot of people, and then once it happened, then there wasn't that long before the referendums were taking place, and there was actually no organized opposition in the other three zones where there were referendums. We had a little more time than the other areas, and so we had until August 7, and we got in gear, and people responded.
So what's your bottom line, Richard Coe? You're a financial planner. If more and more of the country goes to gambling, you know, what does it add up to?
Well, it hurts lots of people. The states that get into this actually have an economic incentive to promote behavior that harms their own citizens. And in the case of Kansas, it was going to be the state of Kansas regulating and policing the casinos that theoretically it owned and operated. It would be like a fox guarding the hen house. And it's really a roadmap for corruption. And many politicians around the country have naively embraced the false promises of the gambling industry. And it hurts people. It hurts families. It's not just the gamblers themselves that get hurt, but for every pathological gambler, there's going to be 7 to 10 other people that get hurt: children, spouses, extended family, employers, friends.
Richard Coe in Wichita, Kansas, thank you for sharing your story with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Richard Coe with Stand Up for Kansas. They knocked it out of Sedgwick County, but as you hear, it's coming in elsewhere in that state. Alan Wolf, what do you hear in this story?
Well, what I hear is that in theory, there are three positions you could have with respect to government and gambling. One is government could prohibit it. The second is that government could be neutral. And the third is government could encourage it. The problem is the second alternative always drops out. Once government doesn't prohibit it, government comes to encourage it. I'm reminded of stories that I hear in Europe where you have very, very high taxes on cigarettes. And the idea is you raise taxes on cigarettes and people will smoke less. But in fact, when government becomes dependent on the tax money, it has an interest
have a smoke.
In encouraging. Right, exactly. And so inevitably, government comes to be, rather than neutral, comes to be invested in the idea of encouraging people to engage in behavior that might in the long run be harmful to them. I don't think that's a good idea. The second thing I hear in this is, you know, this whole idea that we can substitute gambling revenues for taxation. Now, I'm the first to recognize that there's profound anti-tax sentiment in this country. Mm. But whatever you think about taxation, taxation is universal. Taxation says that we all pay taxes and we all get benefits. Gambling is much more selective. Gambling in that sense represents a negative for the whole public's investment in what government does. And it undermines the principle that we all pay and that we all benefit. So from a strictly governmental standpoint, I think there are real costs that we pay in our democracy when we encourage gambling. It's odd because you think, well, people want it. There's no doubt people want it. You put it on the ballot, and like in Kansas, more places are going to. So isn't democracy you give people what they want? But in fact, the whole story of democracy is much more complicated than that. And in many ways, by giving people what they want, we undermine some of the fundamental ideas about citizenship and what it means to belong to a political community.
Michael Nelson, do you see implications for democracy itself here, or does democracy say go with it because it's getting the green light from democratically elected governments?
Well, Alan Wolf's points are all extremely well taken and very persuasive, but there's one thing about Kansas that makes it different from every other state that has legalized casino gambling, and that is in Kansas, the state government will actually own the casinos. And to me, there's a moral difference between the state owning a gambling operation and directly promoting gambling, which is what Kansas is going to do with casinos. It's what 43 states are doing with lotteries.
Isn't that kind of a fig leaf difference, though? If the state is going to profit, for example, in Massachusetts, they'll get some significant percentage of the take if it's legalized here. Doesn't the state have the same interest then in having the gambling billboards everywhere and the ads on TV? They're not doing it, but they've got the same interest, don't they?
Well, I wouldn't say it's the same interest, and I think there's a real difference between the government allowing something to take place, and governments allow all sorts of activities to take place that many people think of as sinful or immoral. It's one thing for the government to allow something. It's another thing for the government to get into the business of doing something, and that's where I see Kansas uniquely among the casino states having crossed what to me is an important line. It's not to say that states that allow casinos don't benefit from taxation, but as Alan Wolf pointed out, casinos are taxed in the same way that all other businesses are taxed.
Mm-hmm. Let me take a call from Albuquerque, New Mexico. David is on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Well, gentlemen, I appreciate being on your program. Here's my issue. I'm wondering, is this really mainly not so much conservatives cutting taxes as it is Nevada envy? Because if I'm not mistaken, Las Vegas through the last part of the 90s and most of this century has had the highest growth rate in the nation. And as a professional driver, I drive on all of their roads, and I can tell you they have the best roads in the nation. They keep their streets clean, they keep their roads up, and I think most of that revenue is generated from gambling.
So do we have Nevada envy going on here? Michael Nelson, how about it? Everybody wants to be Las Vegas. Can that happen?
Well, you know, everybody
never mind,
like
should
to,
it?
Sorry. Everybody would like to be first, but Nevada was first, and Las Vegas was first. And by the way, more than half the commercial casinos in the country are in Nevada. So they've sort of staked out the position as the place to go to gamble. They have the lowest, by the way, the state of Nevada has the lowest tax rate on casinos of any state in the country. It's 6.75%. But that generates over $1 billion a year for Nevada, and some of that money goes to the city of Las Vegas, the city of Reno, the counties, and so on, that they can use for the kind of services your caller's talking about.
But maybe not everybody can be Las Vegas. We're talking about gambling in the USA. It's been on an enormous roll lately. Many, many states see it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Alan Wolf, let's look at the issue that you brought up earlier. I forget who you were quoting. Was it somebody saying, look, the stock market is just another example of this? Now, this is kind of a left extreme view. But on the other hand, everybody's got in their 401ks these days, if they're lucky enough to have one, you know, in some piece of the stock market. I mean, are we being led between gambling and not just and more to see life as a game of chance? Does that change the way we approach the undertakings of life, the way we approach each other, the way we approach work and career? I don't know. Is that a stretch?
Well, no, because gambling involves risk, and risk is part of everything we do. I mean, there's this really fascinating interest in Freakonomics, yeah. You know, in some of the odd things we do. In the book Freakonomics, they point out that parents would never send their child to a house where they know that their neighbor owns a gun, but they will send their child to a house where the neighbor has a swimming pool. And then they say, aha, swimming pools, we know statistically, are much more dangerous than guns. So people are irrational. But there's a certain amount of risk. There's a certain amount of irrationality in everything we do. But I think it is generally the case that most people try to lower the amount of risk. That's why the stock market analogy really doesn't work. There are day traders who are exactly like gamblers. But actually, most people, when they invest in the stock market, go for mutual funds that spread the risk for long term. Don't take out your money kind of things, because you want to reduce the amount of risk.
But is there an erosion of confidence somehow in the system, in playing by the rules, what the little guys, Bill Clinton used to say, that leads people to say, well, you know what, play by the rules and I'm never going to get ahead. Let me put my money on, you know, on this ace of spades right here.
Yeah, no, social scientists say that, you know, societies are successful to the extent they have long-term relationships, that people have certain trust in the future, and so on. But like Mike Nelson said about the arms race among states, once those things break down, then there's an incentive for everybody to try to, it's like a bank run. You want to get your money out as fast as possible. That's why I think government really should be in the business of reducing the amount of risks that people take. I mean, that's what Social Security is all about. The reason why President Bush's plan to privatize Social Security failed was because even Republicans recognized that if you make Social Security a wager, that it's going to undermine the whole principle that some things in life need to be taken out of the risk pool as much as we can.
Not a crapshoot, please.
Yeah, you can never eliminate risk entirely. By encouraging gambling, we're putting more things in the risk pool. And I think that's the issue. I would never want to live in a no-risk society. You could never have a no-risk.
Absolutely.
Risk is part of what makes life wonderful. But you also have to recognize that there are limits to risk, because the consequences of a nation in which everyone risks everything all the time would be to undermine the whole principles that make society work.
Michael Nelson, we've just got 10 seconds here. Look out 10 or 20 years. Can we have double the number of casinos? Are we nearing saturation, or lots more to come?
A lot more to come. The question is, will it be the kind of casinos that you walk into, or will it be the kind of casinos that you get onto through your computer? Internet gambling, which we haven't talked about, is absolutely exploding.
Could be all gambling all the time if we go that way, and maybe we will. Michael Nelson in Memphis, author of the new book, How the South Joined the Gambling Nation. Great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Alan Wolf, director of the Boisy Center for Religion and American Public Life at Boston College. Alan, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. We're having a big conference for those of you in Boston.
Coming
October
up.
October 25th and 26th.
Okay.
You're public invited.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point.
She'd have a heart. She'd have a soul. A lady wouldn't make little snake eyes at me when I've bet my life on this roll. So let's keep the party polite.
So let's keep the party polite.
Never get out of my sight.
Never get out of my sight.
Stick with me, baby. I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady.
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 What's the matter? Roll the dice.